Tom Swift and His Giant Telescope, Victor Appleton. Listen to and download free AI-generated audiobooks at threeords.com. The Project Gutenberg ebook of Tom Swift and His Giant Telescope. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook title. Tom Swift and His Giant Telescope author. Victor Appleton illustrator. James Gary release date. April 19, 2007, ebook 21188. Most recently updated. January 2, 2021 language. English other information and formats. www.gutenberg.org/ebook/21188 credits. Produced by Greg Weeks, Graham Macrith, and the online distributed proofreading team at https://www.pgdp.net. Asterisk start of the project GUTENBRGEBOOK Tom Swift and His Giant Telescope **. Tom Swift and His Giant Telescope by Victor Appleton. Illustrations by James Gary. Whitman Publishing Company, Racine, Wisconsin. Copyright 1939 by Whitman Publishing Company, Racine, Wisconsin. All rights reserved. Printed in U.S. A. Transcriber's note. Extensive research did not uncover any evidence that the copyright on this publication was renewed. Contents, chapter The New Project, Suspicions, An Accident, A Murderous Attempt, In Peril, Tom Drugged Deep Sea Diving, Trapped by a Sea Monster, A Robber, Success, Calm Tom Swift Appeared, Calm Tom Swift, and His Giant Telescope, Chapter I The New Project, Tom Swift appeared to be calm, although in reality he was about as excited over his latest invention as he ever had been about anything in his life. I'm sure it's going to work, Ned. He said eagerly to his chum as they neared Tom's private laboratory. With my new device I hope to learn more about the planets. I want to start soon. Listen here, broke in Ned Newton. If you're thinking of going to Mars or the moon, just count me out. I've gone with you to many strange places and have never kicked. But this, hold on, young fellow, interrupted the youthful inventor with an amused chuckle. I've nothing like that in mind yet. All I want to do is show you my new space. I, Ned. Ned Newton, Tom's chum, can't say as I like that word. Yet, End muttered darkly. But I'll take a look at your new jigger if you'll promise not to shoot me through space in a rocket or cannonball. Word of honor, I won't, promised Tom, crossing his heart with mock solemnity. Well, here we are. The two boys had reached the laboratory, a small building at the rear of the spacious lawn surrounding Tom's father's home and close to the extensive work of the Swift Manufacturing Company at Shopton, Hart. Tom crossed his heart. I'll bet these shelves have more scientific apparatus on them than any other shelves in the world, remarked End as his chum opened the door. Various cabinets containing hundreds of chemicals stood about. Against one wall was a huge transformer, from which the youthful scientist Tom Swift could draw almost any kind of electric current he might desire. They entered the laboratory. Here goes, said the young inventor. He rolled back a small rug in the middle of the floor to expose a massive steel trap door. This he unlocked by twirling the dial of a complicated mechanism. Some years before, Tom had constructed beneath his laboratory an impregnable chamber to safeguard his secret plans. He called it his chest of secrets and guarded it well. Tom rolled back a small rug. Even N. Newton, Tom's closest friend and business associate, did not know the entire contents of the massive vault. Only Tom and his father were aware of all the inventions concealed there. Some of these inventions must not be known to the world in its present state. The elder man had said one of them was the terrible electric death ray capable of destroying anything in its path. Only if the United States should be invaded by an enemy power would this be revealed. There was a death ray. Here it is, said Tom, joining his chum after a few minutes spent in the vault. He was carrying a small wooden box which he placed on the desk and opened. If End, as he leaned over eagerly, expected to see anything astonishing, he was disappointed. Resting on the velvet lining was simply a round disc of a greenish substance, perhaps 6 inches in diameter. This was mounted in a gleaming metal ring from the edges of which there projected 5 electric binding posts. He was carrying a wooden box. Funny kind of an eye, observed Ned. You can't even see through it. You'll soon see through it all, Right, retorted Tom, laying the disc on his desk and connecting four dry cells to the binding posts. He placed a small rheostat in the circuit so that the strength of the current might be regulated. Disc. The disc was mounted in a metal ring. Slowly he moved the little handle over the graduated dial. A minute passed during which, so far as Ned could see, nothing happened. Without warning, the green crystal suddenly glowed brightly for a fraction of a second, then could not be seen at all. The polished ring of metal in which it had been mounted alone remained. It's gone, cried End in bewilderment. I can see your desktop right through where it was. No, smiled the inventor, it's still there, as you'll find if you try to poke your finger through the metal ring. Gone. It's gone, cried End, a trifle gingerly. His chum extended his hand toward the circle of metal. Though Tom had assured him that the little disc was still in place, End was unable to repress a start when his finger touched a cool, polished surface, which his eyes told him could not be there. Say, that's wonderful, he exclaimed, staring at the invisible substance with awe. That stuff must be 100 times more transparent than the finest plate glass. Surface. His finger touched the cool surface. Yes, and more, said Tom, but that's not the most wonderful feature of the new substance. What then? Well, it's difficult to explain. Even now, I know very little about it. I can tell you what it can do. But the why is still as much of a mystery as ever. Briefly, this new element, or maybe it's a compound, I'm not sure which, reacts in a very strange manner to light. Let me show you. That'll beat any long-winded theory I could spout. Wonderful. That's wonderful, he exclaimed. Going to the door, Tom called in his giant servant Koku, who once had been a prince in his own far-off, savage land before Tom Swift had brought him to Shopton. What want, master? Came a deep-toned reply as the huge dark-skinned man, who stood a trifle over 8 feet in height, entered. Just carry outside that telescope, there in the corner, requested Tom, pointing to the instrument. Better be careful, it's a bit heavy. Koku, Tom's giant servant Koku. Not heavy for Koku, boomed the giant. Lift him in one hand. Though it was not a large instrument, as telescopes go, this one, with the massive iron pier upon which it was mounted, weighed not far from 400 pounds. When Koku clamped his mighty hand about the stand, he seemed to lift it as easily as a boy might raise baseball bat or a golf club lifted. Koku lifted it easily. I'll never get used to his strength, murmured End, as the boys followed the giant through the laboratory door, Tom carrying his marvelous green disc. He is a big boy for fair, laughed Tom. Lucky for our prize fighters he hasn't gone into the ring. After carefully placing the telescope where the inventor directed, Koku returned to the bench under a nearby apple tree, where it was his wont to rest when he was not needed. Disc. Tom carried the green disc. Now what, Tom? Questioned Ned. Surely you're not expecting to see stars in broad daylight. Oh no, though it could be done, returned Tom, pointing the instrument toward the crest of a wooded hill several miles distant from Shopton. Now we're ready, take a peek. Well, said End, peering into the eyepiece, all I see are a few trees. Peek. Take a peek, invited Tom. Just stand by, directed his friend, clamping his green disc over the front lens or objective of the telescope and turning on the current. As before, the green stuff seemed to vanish. Now look again, he said. No sooner had End put his eye to the instrument than he gave a start. It's magic, he exclaimed. Why, that hill seems as if it were right here, and the view is much brighter. I can see every leaf on the trees, and yes, even a bird's nest and the little birds in it. Magic. It's magic, he exclaimed. Now maybe you have an idea as to how I propose to discover the secret of life on the planets, responded Tom calmly. The secret? What do you mean? Surely you don't expect to see men on Mars. I mean to build a telescope with a space eye big enough and powerful enough to do it. The young inventor's face lit up with a strange light. It's the greatest thing yet, End. Mean? What do you mean? Asked Ned. Chapter II. Suspicions? Yes, said End dubiously, if you can do it. Oh, I'll admit that your invention improves a telescope marvelously, but to see life on another world millions of miles away, well, that sounds like a pretty tall order even for you, Tom Swift. Order. That sounds like a tall order. Let's go back in the lab and I'll tell you more about the project. Tom directed Koku to carry the telescope inside. As the three walked back, the giant suddenly gave a yell. Quick, master. With that, the servant let go the big instrument, placing it with a thud none too gently on the hard ground. In a bound, he was off. Tom and End caught a glimpse of someone just disappearing around the edge of the building. Had the stranger sneaked into the laboratory while Koku's back was turned, Koku bounded off. I hope the space eye isn't smashed, exclaimed Tom, examining the instrument or the telescope lens. Anxiously, End waited as his Chum detached the green disc and held it up. I guess it's okay, said Tom at length. I'll test it in the lab and see. Lifted. I hope the space eye isn't smashed. At this moment, Koku reappeared, saying the intruder had vanished. Moreover, he was very contrite about having handled the telescope roughly. In a few seconds, the fears of the three vanished. Put to the electric test, the disc was found to be all right. Who do you suppose was sneaking around here? Asked End. No telling, replied Tom. But nothing seems to be missing, he added, glancing around. Lifted. Nothing seems to be missing. I hope you're right, said Ned. Now tell me more about this green disc. How did you happen to discover the stuff? As to just what it is, replied the other slowly, I'm not sure yet. When I analyzed it, I found a substance, absolutely new to chemistry. Where did you get it? Asked Ned. I scraped it from that meteorite down in Koku's country in South America, Ned whistled. Ever since we found that thing which we called a planet stone, you've been discovering all sorts of things about it. Scraped. I scraped it from a meteorite. Right now I hope to revolutionize the field of astronomy with it, said Tom. Tell me more about this wonderful green substance. It may be a new compound or it may be an unknown element. Anyway, in experimenting with it, I found that heat and electricity both change the stuff. The former has an apparently permanent effect, while an electric current, as you saw, alters it only temporarily. Heat and electricity change it. Why didn't you make a big disc? Then you could have tested your theory right away, stated Ned Newton. For two good reasons, replied Tom, opening a drawer and taking out a small vial filled with yellow powder. I wasn't sure it would improve a telescope for one thing, and this is the other. He handed the bottle to End. This is all I have on hand of the new stuff. All. This is all I have. X, murmured End, reading the label. But this powder isn't green, and why the X? When the stuff is melted and then cooled, it changes color, explained Tom. As for the X, if you remember your algebra, you know that letter stands for the unknown quantity. Too bad you can't make a huge green disc. Lifted. This powder isn't green? Don't worry about that, smiled his friend. I'll soon have plenty of the powder. You haven't forgot how the natives of Giant Land feared the meteorite and insisted that we take it away. It seems, however, that we got but a small piece of it. Evidently, when it struck the ground, the thing split, the heavier portion burying itself deep in the earth while the part we found remained near the surface. Earthquake. An earthquake caused the upheaval. About 6 weeks ago, Koku got a letter from his brother, King Ammo of Giant Land, telling of an earthquake, which caused the upheaval of the huge stone. His people think we are great magicians or else witch doctors, and Ammo wrote begging us to take the meteorite from his land. Of course, I was only too glad to oblige him. Then you plan going to South America? Bless my passport, but I'm glad to hear that, exclaimed a voice from the open doorway. It seems as if I'm just in time. Mr. Damon, cried both boys together. Mr. Damon, Mr. Damon, cried both boys. A jolly-looking, rather portly gentleman entered, swinging his cane excitedly. Tom and End gave him a warm welcome, for he was a friend of long standing and had accompanied them on many an expedition to remote quarters of the globe. Come in, invited Tom. Sit down, Mr. Damon, and tell us the news. And what was it you were so tickled to hear just now? Added Ned News. Come in and tell us the news. I'll tell you, said the rather eccentric man, for once forgetting to bless something. I'm in trouble, boys, and I need your help. You know we'll do anything we can, Mr. Damon, Tom assured him. Just what is the difficulty? My wife, said the caller glumly. She's the trouble. Lifted. I'm in trouble, boys. On hearing this, both boys experienced no little difficulty in keeping their faces straight. Although Mrs. Damon was a fine woman in many ways, she was inclined to be very domineering where her husband was concerned. Ever since Tom Swift had rescued the man from a band of kidnappers, Mrs. Damon had had a great liking for the youthful scientist. Yet she felt that her husband should remain quietly at home with her and not go off on any wild trips, as the good lady called them. But I don't see well, suppose you explain, suggested Tom Pills. Bless my headache pills. My wife wants me to go on a weekend house party with her next Friday, and I detest them. Bless my headache pills, but it's enough to drive a man distracted. Now, I heard you boys talking about South America as I came in, and I want to go along. Well, Mr. Damon, if we were going south, you know, I'd be only too pleased to have you a member of the party. But End and I were merely talking about a shipment of freight I'm expecting from Giant Land. Koku's country? Asked Mr. Damon, somewhat astonished. I thought Embalada was still unknown to commerce. Bless my bill of lading, if the world isn't moving faster than I thought. Freight, some freight from Giant Land, Tom smiled. I had to arrange for an expedition through the consular. It's at Buenos Aires to get what I want. It seems we didn't receive all of that strange meteorite, even with the help of your magic wig. Lifted, Tom smiled and explained. Even Mr. Damon had to laugh when he recalled the ludicrous situation in which he had been placed, in the jungles of South America, surrounded by savages he had absent-mindedly taken off his wig, thereby frightening the simple natives half out of their wits. They had thought he could scalp himself, at will. Nevertheless, this action had saved the lives of Tom Swift and his party, ultimately enabling them to escape when the giants turned against them. Lifted, they thought he could scalp himself. Ah, those were the days, Tom, sighed the eccentric man. Those were the days. Even if you're not going off to the wilds, maybe you might give me some kind of a job here so that my wife can't drag me off to that house party. I feel it in my very bones that old Hiram Leatherby will be there, and he always singles me out to talk about his fossil collection. I can sympathize with you, muttered End. Mr. Leatherby used to be a director in the bank where I worked before Tom made me his business manager, and I've often thought he was a bit fossilized himself. Lifted, I'll see what can be done. Well, Mr. Damon, I'll see what can be done, promised Tom. Good, came an enthusiastic exclamation. Bless my cup of tea, I'm counting on you. In the meantime, why don't you go up to the house and have our housekeeper, Mrs. Baggert, make you a cup of tea? Stop in the library and see Dad. He's been working too hard lately on his electrical book and he needs company. Lifted, stop in and see Dad. I will, Tom, your father is a mighty fine man. Oh my goodness, bless my poor memory, Tom, but I had some news for you, good or bad, I don't know, but I feel uneasy about it. Tell us what it is, suggested the young inventor. Two men called on me. It's a rather odd thing, you see, last evening I was reading my paper on the porch when two men called on me. Said they were long-lost relatives, cousins, or something of the sort, just back from a stay in South Africa. They seemed nice enough fellows, but bless my family tree, I had never heard of them. At any rate, they seemed to know a good deal about the Damon family, and so I asked them to dinner. What got me thinking something might not be right was the way those chaps tried to pump me about you, Tom. Pump you? Asked young Swift, a puzzled look on his face. About what? Glass, said the eccentric character promptly. Some kind of glass, bless my windshield wiper, what was it? Oh yes, flexible glass, that was it. Pump, they tried to pump me. Tom and End exchanged startled glances. For many months, experiments directed toward the production of a glass as bendable as rubber had been going forward in the Swift plant. Every possible precaution had been taken to cloak the work in deepest secrecy, yet somewhere, evidently a leak had developed. Among Tom's employees, glances, Tom and End exchanged glances. Are these men still at your home, Mr. Damon? Asked End, a worried look on his face. No, they left after dinner. Mr. Brown said they had some important business upstate. Is this glass business some new invention, Tom? I hope it will be. So far, my experiments haven't turned out successfully, but I can't understand how anyone outside our plant could have known about them. Dinner, they left after dinner. Mr. Damon could tell little more about his self-styled relatives. After giving a description of the two men, he took his leave. The boys were rather worried about the information he had brought along. It's not so much the glass, said Tom, for we don't know if it will be a success. What bothers me is the idea of there being a traitor in the shops. I thought we had weeded out all unscrupulous employees. Men. He described the two men. The Apex Glassworks are located in Portville, said End, struck with an idea, 50 miles north of here. Mr. Damon's visitors claim to have business upstate. To my mind, that's more than a coincidence, especially since the Apex people would give their back teeth to get hold of your formula, Tom. Entered. That's more than coincidence. Chapter III, an accident. Oh, I think you're letting your imagination run away with you, Ned, grinned Tom. I know Mr. Stern, the president of Apex, very well, and I'm positive that he wouldn't stand for any underhanded tactics. No, I know Mr. Stern, grinned Tom. I hope you're right, said his business manager. But you know better than anyone else how unscrupulous gangs have tried to steal your inventions. At first it was Happy Harry the Tramp, and the last was Dr. Bane. No telling how many thugs were after you and your father in between. You'd be wise to get some extra guards. I think Koku is well able to handle any intruder, declared Tom confidently. Besides, I think you're getting excited over nothing. You know, Mr. Damon is inclined to make mountains out of molehills. Handle, Koku is able to handle anyone. That's all very well, persisted his friend stubbornly, but just suppose Mr. Damon is right in his suspicions, it'd be too late then to do anything about it. Don't worry, old man, my chest of secrets will hold its contents secure. Against any burglar's attack, now it's late. You'd better stay to dinner. Afterward, if you care to and have no other date, we can talk over some unfinished business. Secrets, the chest would guard the secrets. Thanks, Tom, I'll be glad to spend the evening with you. Locking up the laboratory, the two boys walked leisurely through the warm June twilight toward the big white house. Low in the sky, hung the silvery crescent of the new moon, while almost overhead, Mars glowed brightly. "There's our goal," End murmured. Tom, pointing to the red planet. "I feel sure that our meteorite came from that far-off world." "Goal, there's our goal," End. "Granting that it did come from another planet," objected End, "I don't get the reason why you're so sure it came from Mars. There are 9 planets circling the sun, including the Earth. Ruling out the sun, it seems to me that there is but 1 chance in 8 that you are right." Entered. 9 planets circle the sun. If it were simply a matter of chance, there'd be a lot of weight behind your argument, End. But a lot of other factors enter the problem. I should say that the only planets where life as we know it might exist are Mars and Venus. The latter I ruled out, for astronomers have found that it is forever covered thickly with dense clouds. Thus the inhabitants, if any, must be ignorant of any world but their own. "What have people on the planets got to do with the question, anyhow?" asked End. "Huge chunks of metal break off of any heavenly body and go hurtling through space. The inhabitants don't throw them off. Metal, chunks of metal rushing through space. But our meteor was no ordinary one, as we have proved already," replied Tom. "I firmly believe that someone on another planet deliberately fired that missile into space, hoping it would reach this world, since scientists agree that Mars probably is inhabited by a highly intelligent race. That planet is a reasonable guess." "Hugh," whistled End. "Such ideas are beyond me. Planet, someone on another planet fired the missile." As he finished speaking, the boys reached the Swift residence. The young inventor's father had built the handsome White House many years before his son was born. Beyond were the several buildings where the inventions of Tom Swift and his father Barton Swift were manufactured. Of recent years, the latter had not been active, but had put the affairs in the hands of his capable son Tom, ably assisted by Ned Newton. The older man now spent most of his time writing scientific books and articles. Residence. The boys reached the Swift residence. The boys washed as quickly as possible so as not to delay dinner, for both possessed healthy appetites. Joining Mr. Swift in the library, they found him and Mr. Damon deep in a game of chess. "Check," cried Tom's father triumphantly, moving his king. "Got you again, Damon. Bless my pawns and castles," exclaimed the eccentric gentleman. "You've won 3 straight games." "Father, Mr. Swift, Tom's father." "Hello, Dad," said Tom suddenly. "I see you're up to your old tricks." In spite of his bantering tone, the young inventor was pleased that his father was relaxing in a friendly game. "Your father shouldn't be in the amateur class anymore, Tom," Mr. Damon grumbled playfully. "Bless my trophy cup, but I'm afraid to play with him." "Better luck next time," consoled Mr. Swift, a twinkle in his eye. Mr. Damon left, refusing an invitation to dinner and saying that he had to take his car to a garage for a minor repair job before starting for his home in Waterford, a nearby town. "Hello." "Hello, Dad," said Tom. "How goes it with you, son?" asked Mr. Swift when Tom returned from seeing his guest to the door. "Your new space eye, as you call it, is it working out?" "I think so, Dad, but wait until I get the big model built." Door. Tom saw Mr. Damon to the door. "Gentlemen's dinner am served." An old Negro thrust his white-fringed head through the library door. "And it show am good." Eradicate Sampson, so called for his work in younger days of eradicating dirt from the homes of Shopton, had been attached to the Swift household for many years and now regarded himself as one of the family. As they sat at table, the conversation of the three turned naturally to Tom's latest invention. Mr. Swift had not heard yet all Tom's ideas of the proposed telescope and was full of eager questions. Eradicate Sampson. "Just how long do you think it will take to make your big disc, son?" asked Mr. Swift. "That is, if you find any more of the new material." "The meteorite is already on board a northbound freight steamer," answered Tom, "and ought to get here within the next 10 days. It'll require at least 3 weeks to extract all the X and cast it into shape. Taking everything into consideration, I should say it will be at least 6 weeks before we can test the device. The matter depends entirely on finding a lot of X in the planet stone, but I'm sure I shall." "Northbound. The meteorite is northbound." After dinner, the boys went over to the main office of the Swift Construction Company to clear up a number of routine business matters, which required Tom's personal attention. He had postponed them for a while to give more time to his new experiments. Office. The boys went to the main office. "Now, young fellow, I'm not letting you get away until you've looked over these papers," declared Ned, pretending to threaten his chum with a yardstick. "I've been after you for a week about 'em." Tom dodged and pretended to be scared. "You're right, though," he admitted. The two worked rapidly. Within an hour, the seemingly endless stack of documents had shrunk to a few letters and bills. Just as Ned was reaching for one of them, the telephone rang in the outer office. Rapidly. The two worked rapidly. "I'll get it, Tom," his chum said. "Sit still," replied the young inventor. "I'll switch it to my private phone." "Tom Swift speaking," he said into the mouthpiece a moment later. "Oh, hello, Mrs. Damon, what's that? But I don't understand. No, there must be some mistake." A loud click sounded in the receiver and Tom jerked the instrument from his ear. "What's wrong?" asked End, noting his friend's serious face. "Ear." Tom jerked the instrument from his ear. "Mr. Damon's been hurt in an auto accident. For some reason, his wife is blaming it on me. Come, we must get to the hospital at once." "Hurt. Mr. Damon's been hurt." Chapter IV, A Murderous Attempt. "You drive, Tom," said End, for they had come from the Swift home in his car. "Okay, and hang on to your hat." Tom Swift had once driven a fast, racing auto of his own design, and Ned knew his chum could get the most out of his roadster. In a few seconds, the little car reached the gate of the works, where the watchman halted them. "Hat. Hang on to your hat." "Oh, and 'tis you again, Mr. Swift," said Maligan. "Sure, and I wouldn't have stopped yez but me. Orders is to inspect Ivoryone." "You did right, Pat," commended Tom, shifting gears. "Good night." The Shopton Hospital was located a couple of miles from the Swift plant. Under the young scientist's guidance, the roadster reached its entrance within a few minutes. At the information desk, the boys were informed where Mr. Damon had been taken. Hospital. They reached the hospital. "Room 302, Mr. Swift. Dr. Chilton is with him now." Just as the boys reached room 302, the physician came out. Tom was glad to note that the man was smiling. "How is he, doctor? Doctor. How is he, doctor?" "Hello, boys. Mr. Damon will be as good as new in a week or so, barring a sprained wrist. His injuries are trifling, a few bruises and a slight cut. From the way he's blessing everything in the place, no one would think he was hurt in the least." "I'm relieved," said Tom. "May we see him?" "Go right in. He'll be glad to have some company, but don't stay too long." "Bless my operating table if it isn't Tom and End," exclaimed Mr. Damon, seeing his visitors enter. The eccentric gentleman was propped up in bed by several pillows. His left arm was in a sling and around his head was a big bandage. "You two got here almost as quickly as I did, but I'm glad they didn't have to carry you in bed." "Mr. Damon was propped up in bed. Your wife phoned me the news," explained Tom. "We're mighty glad you weren't injured badly. Tell us how it happened." "It all occurred so suddenly that I hardly know myself, but I know one thing." Mr. Damon seemed very indignant. "The scoundrels deliberately ran into my car." "Car. The scoundrels ran into my car. Did you get their license number?" inquired N. Newton. "If you did, I'll call the police." "No, I couldn't see it in the dark. But I know the villains well enough. They were my two so-called relatives that I told you about, Jones and Brown. It was spite work for my refusal to tell M about your glass." Tom now saw the reason why Mrs. Damon was blaming him for the accident. "Relatives. My two so-called relatives. We'll notify the authorities and also do a little detective work ourselves," he said. "We must leave now because the doctor wants you to get some rest. Come back again, boys. At any rate, I've escaped that house party." After reporting the accident at the local police station, Tom and Ned visited all the garages and repair shops in the little town in an attempt to learn if any damaged machine had been brought in. They met with no success, however. They visited all the garages. "Guess their bus wasn't hurt much," commented End as they left the last place. "We might as well give up for the night. The police will be on the job. Unless the two men hid the car somewhere, it's sure to be found. The teletype will flash the word all through the state." The following morning, the police chief telephoned Tom to tell him that no trace of the mysterious Jones and Brown could be discovered, nor had any witness to the accident been located. The police chief called Tom. Later, End went to the hospital, where he found Mr. Damon much improved and able to sit up in a wheelchair. After a visit with him, he attended to some business at the bank. On returning to the Swift plant, he found Tom busy with his green disc, which once more was clamped to the little telescope. "Mr. Damon is a lot better," Ned reported, watching his friends work curiously. "When I left him, he was blessing his hat and coat, so I suppose he's eager to get out of the hospital." "Mr. Damon was much improved." "That's great," said Tom. I knew he was getting along all right. I was too busy to go with you, so I called Dr. Chilton. He told me that the x-ray showed no broken bones, but our friend must remain under observation for a few days more. You've changed the wiring on the disc, haven't you? Asked End, who knew a little about electricity. I want to try alternating current. I want to try alternating current instead of direct and see if doing so won't improve it. Dad suggested that. What is it, Koku? Boy Brigham letter for master, say must put name on book. The man held out an envelope and pad. It's a radiogram. Sign for me, Ned, will you? Tom ripped open the envelope and glanced over the message. Bad news? Asked his chum, seeing a changed expression on the inventor's face. Tom ripped open the envelope. I should say so. Here, read it yourself. We might just as well forget the whole telescope idea. That's how bad it is. Ned took the sheet, which Tom had crumpled, spread it out on the desk, and read as follows. Regret inform you was compelled to jettison your cargo last night in bad storm to save ship. Approximate, location 4 miles due east, Port Baracoa, Cuba. Salvage, boat take position at apex isosceles triangle 27.6 degrees with lighthouse and summit hill a mile to the south. Signed, A. Mawson, Captain S.S. Perry, was compelled to jettison your cargo. Say, Tom, that is tough having your meteorite thrown overboard, exclaimed End, rereading the message. All your work wasted and your marvelous invention junked. Not yet, broke in the young scientist grimly as he grabbed the telephone from his desk. Hello, operator, get me long distance, please. Tom grabbed the telephone. What are you going to do? Asked End excitedly. Get divers, replied Tom as he waited. I'm going to recover that meteorite or know the reason. Oh, hello, yes, I want the main office of the Neptune Salvage Company in New York City. No, I haven't, the address. Yes, I'll hold the line. These people are experts, he told his chum while waiting for his call to be put through. If the stone isn't in too deep water, they'll be able to raise it if anyone can. I'm going to recover the meteorite. But how can they ever find it? Seems to me it'll be like hunting for the proverbial needle in a haystack, only more so. Not quite that bad. Captain, Mawson gives what seem to be pretty complete directions. You might try getting any further data the man may have. Captain Mawson gave directions. Unfortunately for Tom, as he learned in the next 2 hours, the Neptune Company and other salvage concerns he called were very busy and could not spare a barge of the required size. Moreover, Ned could get no more information when he finally contacted the freighter than her commander had given already. Why don't yo tack yo submarine boat down Dara Massa, Tom? Asked Eradicate as he served luncheon to the young inventor, his father and End. Ah, members. We once got some treasure, often de bottom ob de sea dat way. Eradicate served luncheon. I did think of that, Rad, answered Tom a bit wearily, but my ship isn't big enough to raise such a great weight. And so, son, said the elder, Swift, if you can't get the use of a large salvage craft, you will have to give up your project, is that right? That's right, Dad, and I surely hate to think of it. But I'm not going to give up even if I have to bring men and equipment from the Pacific coast. I'm not going to give up. That'd be mighty expensive, objected End. In his capacity as the Swift's business manager, he had earned the nickname Watchdog of the Treasury. Why not wait until some local firm can take the job? Too risky. You see, ocean currents or some submarine upheaval might shift the big stone so great, a distance that we could never find it. Don't forget that to the best of our knowledge, the meteorite is the only source of X on Earth. Ocean currents might shift the stone, frowned Mr. Swift. I used to know an old fellow very well who was in the diving business, met him when we built the submarine Advance, you boys remember her, but I can't seem to recall his name. Let me see, ha, I have it. Britton, that's it, John Britton, the best salvage man on the coast. Maybe he's busy too, said End, as all the others seem to be. Maybe he's busy too. I think not, replied the elderly scientist, because he's retired. Yet. I believe he'll undertake the job if I ask him, as I once did him a great favor. His salvaging outfit is in Florida, but he lives on Delaware Bay. I'll phone him at once. That's great, Dad, cried Tom, his face lighting up with renewed hope. Tell him I'll bring him here by plane tomorrow. We can talk things over and start for Florida from here. He'll go, said Mr. Swift a few minutes later, turning away from the telephone with a smile. Said he'll be tickled to get back in harness. He'll go, said Mr. Swift. Thanks a million, Dad. You've saved the day. The following morning, the boys hurried out to the Swift private airport to oversee the fueling of the huge plane Tom had decided to take. At first, he had thought of making the trip in his small two-seated racer, since it was the fastest craft in the hangar. Realizing, however, that Captain Britton might want to bring along considerable baggage, the young inventor had told End he felt it best to go in, his flying boat. They fueled the huge plane. The Winged Arrow, in which Tom once had made a memorable rescue flight to Iceland, was equipped now with a retractable landing gear as well as with pontoons, enabling the craft to descend on both land and water. Suddenly, Tom became very excited as he looked at the hydroplane. "Look, End," he cried. "Can you beat that?" "Look, End," Tom cried. Chapter V. In peril. Upon inspection, it was found that 3 half-inch holes had been drilled into each pontoon. It was evident that only an enemy of Tom or of the Swift Company could have done such a thing. "And that proves it," declared the young inventor gloomily. "3 holes in each pontoon." "Proves what?" End asked. "Can't you see it all ties in with Mr. Damon's so-called relatives and their knowledge of my formula for a bendable glass? Someone in our shops is a traitor or worse." "But what has a damaged hydroplane to do with that?" objected Ned. "If we had landed on water with these damaged pontoons, we'd have drowned most likely," replied Tom. "That would have suited the villains who want my formula, and no one would have been the wiser as to what caused the accident. We'd have been drowned." "Admitting you're right, the thing's a pretty serious mess," said Ned. "But of course crooked people will go to long lengths for money, and if your formula is a good one, it certainly will bring a lot of money to someone or something. And that something is going to be the Swift Company," declared Tom. "It's a pretty serious mess. Since we can't take off in the hydroplane today," said End, "let's go back to the office. I suppose it'll require some time to patch up those holes." Tom immediately sent for one of his skilled mechanics, a man whom he knew to be trustworthy. He set the fellow to work welding patches over the holes. After cautioning his employee to maintain strict silence, he and End drove away. He welded patches over the holes. "Don't say anything to Dad about this," warned Tom as the two left the field. "It would only worry him and could do no good. You and I must work out this mess by ourselves." After dinner that evening, Tom went to his private laboratory to check the thermostat controlling the temperature of the annealing oven in which his batch of new glass was being slowly cooled. Then he spent some time at his desk over certain intricate formulas. The room was in semi-darkness, lighted only by a shaded reading lamp. Tom checked the thermostat. "Well, that's that," yawned the young inventor at length, locking up his desk. "Guess I'd better put the valuable disc back in the vault before I go home," he decided, switching on the ceiling lights and glancing toward the corner where Koku had placed the telescope. With a start, he saw that his invention was gone. His invention was gone. Quickly examining the instrument, he found that the green disc had been jerked roughly from its clamps by someone who evidently had been in too great a hurry to bother unscrewing the bolt switch had held it in place. "Ho!" suddenly boomed a deep voice. Tom became aware of a commotion outside the laboratory. "You know, get away from me. How you like another knock on top head? Don't hit me again," whined someone. "I won't try to escape." Tom flung open the door and saw his giant servant dragging a man up the steps. A feeling of tremendous relief swept over young Swift as he discovered his precious green disc in Koku's left hand. Koku was dragging a man. "Ha, Master Tom, catch him, bad man's trying to sneak through gate. See green thing stick out of pocket and grab him, bring him here, want me hit him again? Please don't let him hurt me, Mr. Swift," snivelled the man. "He hit me an awful blow back there. Want me hit him again? You had it coming to you," retorted Tom sternly. "Besides, you're not hurt very much. Koku, bring him in here. You certainly did a good piece of work when you nabbed this fellow. Take him into the office and we'll have a word or two with him before I call the police." "I ain't talking," muttered the man, shifting uncomfortably and looking rather uneasily at the giant. "You ain't got nothing on me. I just found that chunk of green glass in the field. You ain't got nothing on me. Don't lie to me unless you want to be mussed up some more," said Tom grimly, glancing at Koku. "I think I'll just take a look through your pockets. Perhaps you found a few other little things when you broke in here." Under the menacing eye of the giant, the man submitted sullenly to the search. There was nothing in his clothes to identify him. Apparently, he had stolen nothing else from the laboratory. He refused to answer any questions, however. Tom gave up and summoned the police by telephone. Tom searched the man. "Oh, master, here other thing in man's pocket," exclaimed Koku. After the thief had been carted away to jail, "It stuck to round green thing when I yank away from He handed Tom a bit of pasteboard from which the lower third had been torn. "It's a business card of the Apex. Glass works with the representative's name ripped off," exclaimed young Swift aloud. Then to himself, he added, "I wonder, maybe Ned was right after all and they are after my formula for bendable glass." "A business card." Tom immediately called the home of Mr. Stern, head of the glass works to whom he related the occurrence. The executive was shocked and very indignant at the thought of there being a criminal among his employees and promised to investigate thoroughly. "I hope you don't think I had anything to do with this, Mr. Swift," the man exclaimed. The executive was shocked. "Not in the least, sir. But if you turn up any clues, I hope you'll let me know." "I most assuredly will. You may count on my help." An early hour next day found Tom and End flying south over the sandy coast of New Jersey. Every inch of the Winged Arrow had been thoroughly inspected, but no other signs of damage had been discovered. Even so, the young business manager sat a bit uneasily in his seat as he peered out anxiously at the broad wings. Tom and End flew south. "Afraid they'll drop off, old man?" grinned Tom. "Don't worry, we x-rayed them and no struts have been filed nor any time bombs planted." "Huh, I was just looking at the weather," grunted End indignantly. He was secretly relieved, for he had been pondering how easily a charge of dynamite could have been secreted aboard ship. "How soon do you think we'll reach Delaware Bay?" Ned was uneasy. "Within the next 20 minutes, answered his chum, glancing at the instrument board. "Mr. Britton is to meet us at a dock near Lewes." Less than half an hour later, the pontoons of the Winged Arrow were plowing through the waters of Delaware Bay toward a nearby pier. A wharf attendant caught the line end through him, and the ship was moored securely to a stout post as Tom and his companion climbed up. A grizzled-looking old man hailed them in a voice that seemed well able to travel from quarterdeck to forecastle even in the teeth of a hurricane. The plane plowed through the waters. "Ahoy there," he bellowed, though scarcely 20 feet away. "Are you young Swift and company?" "Right you are, Captain Britton, I take it." Vastly flattered by the title, the red-faced old seaman warmly shook hands with the boys. "Correct, ye are me lad. Your good father tells me you need a bit o' salvagin'. Done, and I'm the man as'll do it proper, Captain Britton, the grizzled old man." "Good for you, Captain," said Tom. "That's exactly what my father said. And now have you your equipment handy? If it's not too heavy, we can load it aboard the plane right away. Oh, and I want to introduce my good friend here, Ned Newton. I want to introduce my friend. Glad to meet ye, shipmate. As for my salvagin' outfit, it's aboard ship. We'll pick up my old barge, the Elizabeth B, but I calls her the Betsy B, at Key West, where I keeps her anchored. She's an A manner o' speakin' my winter home." Captain Britton picked up a huge, battered old suitcase. "If your flyin' machine is ready, so am I." The old man was obviously a trifle eccentric, but both boys were warmly attracted to him by his sincere and friendly manner. Besides, as Tom noted, there was a certain air of competence about him, as if he was well able to tackle and solve the hardest of problems in his line. Captain Britton carried his suitcase. "Let's go then," proposed End, motioning to the attendant to cast off and handing him a coin at the same time, listening to a number of quaint seafaring expressions from old Captain Britton, who was starting his first voyage into the upper air. Tom sent the big craft roaring above the smooth water toward Shopton. "How do you like flying, Captain Brit?" End asked. "Ever been up?" "Well, I guess it's all right," rumbled the salvaging expert, looking down at the sea dubiously. "But to tell you the truth, I'm more at home on the water than over it." In a short time, the nose of the Winged Arrow turned inland as Tom set his course direct for home. When they were nearing Shopton, the young inventor, intending to come down on solid ground, grasped the device which lowered the landing wheels. It seemed to work very stiffly, he thought, so he leaned over farther to exert more force. Suddenly, there came a snapping noise. The plane turned inland. "What's up, Tom?" called End, hearing the noise and seeing his chum fumbling with the now useless mechanism. "Landing gear out of commission, but there's no need to worry, as we can descend on Lake Carlopa easily with the pontoons." "Landing gear out of commission. By George," exclaimed Ned Newton, banging his fist on the instrument panel. 10 to 1, this is the work of the same scoundrel who bored holes in the floats. If I could get my hands on—" "I hope you'll be in a condition to do so," cut in Tom in an oddly strained voice. "Take a look at the fuel gauge. It says zero, but that's impossible. We saw the tanks filled last night. Look at the fuel gauge." "Sure, and when we took off this morning, the gauge showed they were still full. Someone tampered with the pointer of the instrument and all but drained the gas containers when they wrecked the landing gear. Just now you dislodged the jammed needle when you struck the instrument board with your fist. Then we're in a pretty bad way, eh, Tom?" asked Captain Britton calmly. "We're in a pretty bad way, I'll say," replied young Swift grimly. "We can't hope to reach Carlopa, and there is nothing beneath us now but thick woodland, no question about it. A crack-up is the next thing on the program." As he finished speaking, the starboard motor emitted a groaning cough and stopped. The port engine might run for another 5 Minutes or it might give out within. The next 5 seconds, the starboard engine stopped. Chapter VI, Tom drugged. Tom had headed the ship up at a steep angle so as to get as much altitude as possible before the other motor should stop. But he knew, in his heart, that he could not hope to glide so heavy a plane as far as the lake. Tom headed the ship up. In some surprise, End observed that Captain Britain was fumbling with the straps about his big, old-fashioned valise. Young Newton wondered what the elderly man was looking for so intensely. "Ahoy there, Tom Swift," boomed the old diver, straightening up with a bottle in his hand. "I've got a drop o' gasoline here that may help ye. I've got a drop of gasoline." "What's that?" gasped the pilot. Turning, he saw the quart bottle. Already the remaining engine was dying of thirst. "Quick, End," he ordered, snatching the container. "Take the controls and hold the ship level." 5 seconds later, the inventor was creeping out along one wing toward the intake valve of the port gas tank. Their hearts almost in their mouths, his companions watched his hazardous progress. In spite of the clutching hand of the wind and the quavering of the ship, under End's inexpert guidance, Tom managed to reach his goal. He crept along one wing, removing the cap with no little difficulty. He dumped the precious drops of gasoline into the tank. In a few moments, he got back to the cabin. As he closed the door, the laboring engine once more resumed its full-throated roar. "Lad, you've got what it takes," rumbled Captain Britain, shaking Tom's hand approvingly. "You're a mighty brave young fellow. You mean you had what it takes," laughed the inventor, taking over the controls preparatory to landing on Carlopa. "Without that extra bit of gas, we'd be piled up in a tree by now." He emptied the precious drops. The quart of fuel was just sufficient to carry the ship safely down to the lake's surface at a point about 3 miles from the town. Fortunately, one of Tom's friends was sailing nearby in his catboat and gladly offered to take the three over to the Swift dock, which jutted out from the grounds behind Tom's home. It was mid-afternoon before the Winged Arrow was towed across to the dock and her tanks refilled with high-test gasoline. While this was being done, Tom and End went to the home of Mr. Damon to ask if he would like to accompany them to the West Indies. Tom saw a friend. The man was found to be sitting in an easy chair on his front porch, where he spent much time now that he was home from the hospital. They went to see Mr. Damon. "Bless my parachute, I'd like nothing better than to make the trip," he said a trifle wistfully. "To tell you the truth, though," his voice sank to a whisper, "between the doctors and Mrs. Damon, I'll be lucky if I'm allowed to walk around the block alone for some time to come." "Well, that's too bad, Mr. Damon. We were counting on you. We were counting on you. Bless my fishing tackle, Tom. Sorry too, but tell me, how did Captain Britt happen to be carrying a quart of gasoline in his satchel?" asked the eccentric gentleman after he had been told of the airplane's narrow escape. "I thought it strange myself," said Tom, "but he claimed he always carries some with him to remove grease spots from his clothes. Ha, he must be quite a character. I suppose aboard a salvage boat folks get their clothes pretty dirty at that." After the boys returned home, it was decided that they and Mr. Britton would set out for Florida the next morning. In the meantime, the elderly diver telegraphed his caretaker to get the Betsy B in order and arrange to hire a tugboat. They planned to start the next day. Late in the afternoon, Tom called his chum on the phone. "Can you spare me a few minutes?" he asked. "Think I'm going to have something interesting to show you." "Be right over," replied Ned. "Where are you?" "In the lab." A few minutes later, young Newton had joined his friend. "What's up?" he asked Tom as he entered. "What's up?" asked End. Tom had discovered that his bendable glass mixture had cooled to a critical temperature, making it necessary to remove it from the furnace at once lest it be ruined. In a small secret chamber beneath his private laboratory, he had set up a sort of miniature glassworks, which would have astonished any ordinary glassworker, for the young inventor had devised an entirely new method of procedure. As to its outcome, well, even to its inventor, that feature remained in doubt. A miniature glassworks. "Do you think it'll work, Tom?" asked N. Newton anxiously as he followed the youthful scientist down the stairs. "Your experiments have cost a mint of money already." "Don't croak," chuckled Tom. "I've a few pennies left, haven't I?" "You won't have so very many after you finish with your new telescope idea," declared End grimly. "And that certainly won't bring in any dividends." Ned followed Tom. "Nor is it intended to," said Tom a bit sharply. "There is, you know, such a thing as pursuing knowledge for its own sake." "I'm sorry, you ought to know, though, that I'm thinking only of your interests, not of mine," he said as they reached the room below. "Forgive me, old man," Tom clapped End warmly on the back. "Don't feel for a minute that I don't appreciate everything you've done for me, to tell you the truth. as worried about this new glass as you are. That's why I jumped on you. Let's forget it. Forgive me, old man. Right. The two were standing now before the cylindrical furnace containing the mixture of silicates and other ingredients from which Tom Swift hoped would emerge a glass as flexible as rubber and as strong as steel. The thermometer on the front stood at 21 degrees centigrade. They looked at the thermometer. She's just right, muttered the inventor, consulting a complicated chart hanging on the wall. Now we'll see. The asbestos-coated door clanged open. Tom drew out a shallow tray, the contents of which were buried in a black powder. Charcoal, he explained, setting the pan on a table. It prevents any rapid temperature change. Even common glass must be cooled slowly or it becomes as brittle as peanut candy. Tom drew out a shallow tray with the aid of a wooden rod. Tom pulled out a glass bar about 10 inches long and an inch thick. After picking it up carefully, he examined it closely. In no way did the object appear different from ordinary glass. Well, here goes, said the inventor, and forthwith bent the bar into the shape of a horseshoe. Hurrah, yelled End, clapping his friend on the back. You've done it again, Tom Swift, he bent the glass. Don't crow too soon. Perhaps it won't bend back again. If a rod of copper is annealed in a certain way, it can be bent once like rubber. But then the crystal breaks up, and it becomes as rigid as ever. Maybe this glass will act the same way. Then try it, don't keep me in suspense. Perhaps Tom had been tantalizing his business manager, or maybe he really was doubtful about the flexibility of the bar. At any rate, when he applied pressure, he did not seem surprised when the glass became straight again. Then he proceeded actually to tie a knot in it, so bendable was the new substance. The glass became straight again. This will revolutionize the glass industry, declared End, noting that even the blows of a heavy sledgehammer failed even so much as to crack the rod. It's not half as wonderful as that other kind of glass, said Tom, dreamily. Your glass eye, do you mean? Chuckled End in high good humor. In his mind, he could already see fat profits for the company. A heavy hammer did not crack it. I'll give you a pair of black eyes if you make another bad joke. Laughed Tom, giving his chum a playful push. But seriously, I'm mighty well pleased with this stuff. It turned out better than I dared hope. You know, I got the idea for bendable glass while I was trying to figure out a way to make a huge telescope mirror. That was before we found the meteorite. And I suppose you'll go back to the glass mirror if you can't find the big stone so you can make the large green disc. I'm well pleased with this. Yes, that's what I'll have to do if the salvage attempt fails, but I'm sure we'll succeed. Captain Britain had been given a room at the Swift home. When the boys got there, they found their guest and Tom's father deep in a game of chess. The two men were playing chess. Well, son, laughed Mr. Swift, I've met my match at last. John, Britain has beaten me 3 straight games, but don't tell Damon about it. I won't, Dad, grinned Tom. What do you think of this? He handed his father the bar of bendable glass. What do I think of it? Why, it looks like a glass rod, that's all I can see. Then watch. Tom took the bar and deftly twisted it into the shape of a fat pretzel. You've done it, son, cried Mr. Swift. And to think I told you such a thing was impossible. Congratulations. What do you think of this? At dinner that evening, the conversation turned mainly to the projected flight to the West Indies. It was decided to start the next day at sunrise, as Captain Britain had received word from Florida that his barge had been made ready. A tug was getting up steam to haul it to the Cuban coast. Congratulations, cried Mr. Swift. Mr. Damon can't go with us, Dad, said Tom. His wife won't. Let him, by the way, he added, with a laugh. She was looking up the names of all his relatives. Mr. Damon said she was glad of the excuse to do so, but she could find none named Jones or Brown. So that definitely proves those two fellows were fakes and that they merely pretended relationship in order to pump him about my work. After supper, End went to his home to pack a suitcase, for he was to spend the night at the Swifts, to be on hand for the early start that was being planned. Tom spent the evening in his office studying the latest available data on diving operations and plotting the route over which the party would travel. To the coast of Cuba, Ned packed his suitcase. Immersed in his work, he at first paid but little attention to a peculiar odor that gradually was pervading the atmosphere. Suddenly, he realized that something was wrong. A strange buzzing filled his ears and the lights seemed to be growing dim. He started to get up, but instead fell across his desk. Something was wrong. As Tom lay there motionless, a window opened noiselessly. Stealthily, a masked figure climbed in. After a hasty glance around the room, the intruder hastened to the desk and leaned over the unconscious youth. A masked figure entered. Chapter VII, Deep Sea Diving. Swiftly, the masked man took a bunch of keys from Tom's pocket with a directness that indicated familiarity with the place. He went straight to the rug covering the entrance to the secret vault. Throwing this aside, he unlocked the trap door and quietly raised it. The combination lock, which gave warning if tampered with, had not been set for the night. He unlocked the trap door. Now the intruder very carefully draped the rug over the door in such a way that it would spread itself, as before when the trap should be closed from below. 2 minutes later, Tom was alone in the office, which appeared exactly as it had before he was rendered unconscious. Yet there crouched in the vault a hidden spy whose purpose was as sinister as his appearance. He draped the rug over the door. "Mist Swift, Massa Tomain, come back from de office yet," announced Rad Sampson as he placed the elderly inventor's nightly glass of hot milk on the library table. "I was just up tea his room to ax him, suffin, and he wasn't dar. Well, I guess the boy is working a bit late tonight, but you sound a trifle anxious, Eradicate. Do you think anything is wrong?" "Uh-oh, no, sir, no, sir," mumbled the old Negro. "I just wondered if you'd seen him." "Good night, sir, good night. Massa Tomain back from de office." "Good night, Rad. Mustn't worry ol' Mist Swift," the servant muttered to himself as he shuffled back to the kitchen. "But Massa Tom told me hisself he gwine tea bade early cause he gotta get up before sunrise. Look hiya koku," he went on when he got to the kitchen. "Quit stuffin dat ar pie and go out and see ef Massa Tom all right. He ought tea have been in de house long since. Says skeered meb some villains mought have cotched him. See ef Massa Tom all right." "Woo," growled the giant, jumping up so quickly that his big, specially built chair crashed over. "Where war club, me fix him? Don't make sich a racket, yo, big lummox, yo wanna skeer all Mist Swift, he take my rolling pin." Clutching the rolling pin as a war club, Koku started through the darkness toward Tom's private laboratory. Following him at a discreet distance came old Rad Sampson, who had armed himself with a big butcher knife. Rad followed. "Dar's a light into office, big boy," whispered the Negro. "Be careful now." The giant merely grunted, crept up to the window, and peered within. His great height enabled him to do so easily. "Come," he said, finally turning toward the door. "We go in." "What de matter?" demanded Eradicate, struggling to keep up with his companion. "Em suffin, wrong, ma goodness," he cried a moment later in the office. "Po, Massa Tom done been killed. Look at him a layin' dera," the giant peered in the window. "Him no dead," rumbled Koku, leaning over his master. "Him heart still beat him. Him need fresh air." Gently he picked Tom up and carried him outside. "I'll get a doctor," exclaimed the old colored man. "Dey's a phone in he. Him no dead?" rumbled Koku. Before the physician could be reached, the beneficial effects of the cool night air had brought the young inventor back to consciousness. At first he could not recall what had happened and was not a little astonished to find himself lying on the grass. "What in the world is the matter, Koku?" he demanded, pressing his hand to his aching head. "What am I doing out here?" "Master out, get knock'em," said the giant. "We find you on desk, Rad Callum medicine man now. What am I doing here? A doctor? No, I'm all right, tell him to cancel the call." Tom managed to struggle to his feet. "I remember now, some kind of gas must have been used on me, but I must see to the office. Maybe I've been robbed." Leaning heavily on the giant's arm, Tom walked as fast as he could into the laboratory. At first glance, everything seemed to be in order, and to his relief, he found the vault was locked. The vault was locked. The young inventor did not know that a key was missing from his ring, nor, as he twirled the dial of the combination lock, did he realize that a slender lever had been severed from below, thus rendering useless the intricate mechanism. "Who done dis to you, Massa Tom?" asked Rad. "Wish I knew. Anyhow, there's been no damage done except to me. My head's splitting, so I must get to bed. Koku, stay on guard here from now on until I return from Cuba, and get several of the men to relieve you. Another thing, I don't want either of you to mention this affair to anyone. Dad would hear about it and worry. Koku, stay on guard here. If I catch him, fella, I break him in little bits," cried Koku fiercely. He shook the rolling pin vigorously. "Better him stay way from me." Tom awoke the next morning, little the worse for his experience, thanks to a rugged constitution. He had been able to throw off the ill effects of the poisonous fumes which had overcome him. "Better him stay way from me? I can't make it out end," he said as the boys stood watching the mechanics warm up the engines of the big seaplane. "Nothing is missing. Whoever did the job didn't even rob me, and I had a good deal of cash in my wallet. Maybe nobody made an attempt on you or your property at all," Tom end remarked slowly. "What do you mean? I certainly was knocked out. Oh, I know that, but couldn't some sort of gas have seeped into your office from your adjoining laboratory? A bottle of acid might have cracked, or the mechanics warmed up the engines. Nothing like that happened. Positive, because the same thought struck me, I made a careful inspection this morning. Everything was in perfect order. It certainly is strange, said Ned. It looks as if some enemy is camping on your trail, Tom. He'll have a hard time picking up that same trail in a few minutes, chuckled the inventor. Here come Captain Britain and Dad. I guess we can take off soon. A bottle of acid might have cracked. So your seagoing air yacht is ready to cast off, is she? Asked the old diver. Well, when ye haul in the gangplank, so to speak, I'll be aboard. Take care of yourself, son, said Barton Swift, shaking Tom's hand. I hope you will be successful in your attempt. Goodbye, Dad, and thanks. Don't get it up by no sharks or alligators, cautioned Rad. Take care of yourself, son. The mechanics had finished their work and were seen climbing down from the fuselage. The passengers took their places in the roomy cabin while Tom seated himself behind the controls. After running a critical eye over the score of instruments, he reached for the throttle and clutched the wheel tighter. The intermittent coughing of the powerful motors changed to a deafening roar, and the huge ship lumbered off down the long field, gathering speed every second. Tom sat behind the controls. We're off, cried End, waving at the already distant figures left behind, and we'll bring home the meteorite, muttered Tom to himself as the winged arrow glided smoothly toward the clouds lining the southern horizon. For I'm going to make the most wonderful telescope the world has ever known. We're off, cried Ned. Chapter VIII, Trapped by a Sea Monster. This is travelin' in style, all right, approvingly remarked Captain Britain, looking about the comfortably appointed cabin and sniffing the appetizing odor of lamb chops on the electric grill. When necessary, N. Newton could cook an impromptu meal. He really was rather proud of his ability. Ned cooked some lamb chops as the amateur chef placed the meal on a small, collapsible table. Tom announced that they were now flying over the state of Georgia. We should reach Key West about 3 p.m., he said. The ship droned steadily onward. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they were passing near a large city. Amy, declared End, who had been poring over a chart. Airplanes go to many parts of South America from there. Miami, declared End. Tom sent the winged arrow lower and lower. Finally, he leveled off at an altitude of about 500 feet above the blue sea. Here, the full force of the fierce subtropical sun began to make itself felt. The travelers, fresh from the comparatively cool northern summer, made haste to open all the air vents in the plane. Then they changed into white linen suits. Phew, exclaimed Tom, mopping his brow. I've traveled in the jungles of Africa but have never felt hotter. Ah, it's the ship, my boy. You see, the dark metal hull fairly soaks up the sun, and that's why we're a bit uncomfortable, said Captain Britt. Once we land, you'll think the climate fine. Shortly afterward, they flew over a grim-looking American battleship. It greeted them with a hoarse blast of her whistle as the flying boat shot by at the rate of 200 miles an hour. On either side, tiny islands or keys appeared, then vanished as if by magic. Finally, a blue blur straight ahead began to loom even larger, and in a few minutes the winged arrow landed in the harbor of Key West. They flew over a battleship. 3:30, said Tom, glancing at the clock on the instrument panel. A slow passage. Fast as I'd want to make it, declared Captain Britt. A steamer'd have taken a good many hours where we needed only minutes. There's the old Betsy B. Tied to her pier, so let's get over to her. In the harbor at Key West, the idling engines were speeded up and the flying boat moved slowly across the harbor. A tug with smoke curling from her single thick funnel lay near the broad-beamed barge. A tug lay near the barge. Over the stern of the latter, several grinning Negroes leaned. Their ancestors might have been stricken dumb at sight of the great sky craft tying up to their ship, but these darkies were familiar with daily passage of planes bound for South America and showed but little astonishment. In a liquid Spanish-English patois, they bade the whites welcome. All of them were old retainers of Captain Britain. As the elderly man had said, the old barge had served as winter quarters for him during the past years. In consequence, he had had her little cabins fitted up more luxuriously than is customary on such vessels. Tom and End were given one far more comfortable than they had expected. The cabins were comfortable. The rest of the afternoon was taken up with inspection of the ship, the arrangements for the safekeeping of the winged arrow, and the laying of plans. Immediately after the hydroplane had been moored to a small pier owned by Captain Britain, the tugboat chugged out into the Gulf of Mexico at the rate of 10 knots. The tug chugged out into the Gulf. I'd say we should reach the spot sometime tomorrow afternoon, said Tom after studying the chart. It's just under 200 miles. and we'll get your meteorite. For you, predicted the old salvage man confidently. Lucky the captain of that freighter Perry took a bearing on the lighthouse at Port Barracoa, otherwise it would be like looking for a boll weevil in a bale o' cotton. Tom studied the charts. Ruiz, the coal-black cook, served a good supper at sundown. Shortly, afterward the boys went to their bunks, for both were tired after the long flight. Then too, Tom was still feeling the effects of the gas inhaled the previous night. Next morning found the Betsy B, wallowing through a smooth sea a few miles off the east coast of Cuba. Under the supervision of Captain Britton, several of the crew were busy oiling the huge winch, overhauling steel cables, and seeing to a dozen other minor but important details. Altogether, it was a busy scene that met the eyes of Tom and End when they emerged on deck. The crew was busy. "Your father was right, I think," said End. "You certainly have a competent man. See how the crew jump at his word." "I agree," said Tom with satisfaction. "But me for breakfast, this sea air surely gives a fellow a good appetite." A headwind coupled with a rising sea combined to hold back the tug and her rather clumsy tow as the day waned. Occasional heavy rain squalls made the deck of the barge a rather uncomfortable place, so the boys stayed in the main cabin and discussed plans. Headwinds held back the tug. "I think the rainy season must be at its height," groaned End at last as he and Tom sat sweltering. "Maybe we'll be cooped up here for the whole voyage." Rain kept the boys in their cabins. "Not me," declared the young inventor with a laugh. "Since when have you grown afraid of a little rain? By afternoon we ought to be near the spot where Captain Mawson jettisoned the meteorite, and then we'll begin to get busy, weather or no weather." "I hope the thing will be worth all our trouble," said End a bit crossly. "Perhaps we won't even be able to find it. What then?" "You're just suffering from a touch of mal de mer," teased Tom, refusing to consider his chum's gloomy remarks. "I'm not a bit seasick," protested Ned indignantly. "I just think we're on a wild goose chase, that's all." "I'm not seasick," protested End. "Wait and see." Evening drew nigh and the sudden tropical night fell. On the Cuban coast, lights went on, dominated by the intermittent glare of a powerful beacon many miles ahead. "Barracoa light," announced Captain Britton seeing this. "We will lay offshore till morning and begin our work tomorrow." The captain pointed to the beacon. It spoke well for Tom Swift's nerves that he slept soundly despite his great interest in the morrow's activities. During the night, the sea abated and the rain ceased. Dawn broke with a brilliance to be seen only in tropical lands. In order to reach the spot in the sea beneath which the meteorite lay, it was necessary to get the barge into a position corresponding to the apex of an isosceles triangle in relation to the lighthouse tower and the peak of a small hill. Nearby, Tom made some observations. Captain Britton and Tom, sextants in hand, made repeated observations. Ned stood by the telephone, connecting the tug and her tow, transmitting to the former's captain the navigation directions. Finally, the barge was supposed to be exactly where the freighter had thrown overboard the big stone. "We may have to look around a little, though," remarked Tom as Captain Britton ordered the tug halted and anchors lowered. In the big storm, Captain Mawson might have made a mistake in his reckoning. The chart showed the depth of the water. The water was about 300 feet deep here, the hydrographic office charts showed. When End learned this, he looked serious. "The record depth attained by a diver is only 204 feet, he exclaimed. "At least that's what I read in an encyclopedia. Guess you're referring to James Hooper, who reached that depth off the South American coast some years ago," smiled Tom Swift. "But since then, diving dress has undergone considerable improvement, eh, Captain Britton?" A boom was swung overside. "That's right. I have on board several of the newest type suits. Besides, I use native divers' men, who, even without protection, can descend to almost unbelievable distances." Quickly, a boom was swung out overside. From it hung several pulleys to which was attached a narrow steel platform. Presently, three tall Negroes carried out of the storeroom grotesque-looking diving suits which weighed over 250 pounds apiece. He shuffled across the deck. Captain Britton spoke in Spanish. To one of them, then the fellow began putting on the weird uniform. It made him look like a visitor from another world. The tremendous weight of his garb prevented him from moving at more than a slow shuffle across the deck. Strong though he was, a trail of bubbles, a section of the railing had been removed to allow access to the dangling metal platform upon which the diver stepped. The boom swung out and the drum of the winch began unrolling. In a few seconds, only a trail of vanishing bubbles marked the spot where the Negro had gone into the sea. "How long will it take him to reach bottom?" asked End, peering overside in fascination. About 40 minutes, replied Captain Britain. A diver must be lowered and raised gradually in order to avoid the terrible aftereffects of a sudden change in pressure. At 300 feet, the pressure is more than 18,000 pounds per square foot. Tom held his watch to his ear. Time dragged on. Down, down rolled the heavy cable supporting the diver. Finally, Tom held his watch to his ear as though he were afraid it might have stopped. Oh, it's still running, laughed Ned a little nervously as he observed his chum's action. Only 5 more minutes, Tom, he reported a good sandy bottom. At last a bell tinkled and Captain Britain grabbed up the telephone instrument which connected barge and diver. For a few seconds he listened, then replied briefly in Spanish. Alvarez is down, he said to Tom as he hung up the receiver. He reports a good sandy bottom, but no sight yet of the meteorite. At any rate, there's no danger of it having sunk in an oozy bottom. 10 minutes later the phone buzzed again, this time with a request that the ship be moved a little east and that Manuel Alvarez's mate be sent down to help. This was done and another telephone instrument was plugged in. Manuel was to go down. Tom, who understood a little Spanish, stood by to hear the report of the second diver. Both lines were now kept open continuously. Finally, Manuel reached bottom. Saying that he had contacted Alvarez for some minutes, nothing came through either telephone but the sound of the submerged men's breathing. Something has gone wrong. I see something, senor, a rock, que grande, came to Tom's ears suddenly. It must indeed be that which the senor seeks. But Santa Maria, there is something else. Manuel's voice broke off suddenly. Captain Britt, can you hear your man? Shouted Tom after his repeated attempts to renew the connection had failed. No, I can hear only a muffled groaning. Something has gone wrong, that's sure. Stop, senor, screamed the engineer. Pull him up quick then, advised Ned. This seemed good advice, so the auxiliary engine was started and the winches began turning slowly. Stop, senor, suddenly screamed the native engineer, waving his arms excitedly and cutting off the steam. The drums turn, see, but the cables do not rise. Something has caught the men. Loose the winches. Chapter IX, A Robber. Loose the winches a little, ordered Captain Britain sharply. The air hoses are strained almost to the breaking point. See, mumbled the engineer, easing off the brake a trifle. What's the trouble in your opinion, Captain? Asked Tom. The engineer eased the brake. Hard to say, young fellow, came the worried reply. What I'm afraid of is that a huge octopus or some such monster has attacked the poor divers. Whatever it is, I fear it's the end for 'em as theirs. Not another diver aboard, and we can't haul the men up for fear of breaking their airlines. Have you another diving suit? Asked Tom rapidly. I've had considerable experience in undersea work and can't let those boys drown without trying to help 'em. I'm afraid it is an octopus. Can you do it, lad? Yes, I've a brand new outfit aboard that's of the latest type. But what'll I say to your father if anything happens to you? Dad wouldn't want me to stand back at a time like this, rejoined the young inventor. I sent these men down and it's up to me to see they get back safely. But Tom, cried End, what of the octopus? You may be trapped too and not save Manuel and Alvarez either. It's up to me. You forget, or maybe you didn't know, that I brought my electric rifle with me. That'll polish off any devilfish I'm likely to meet. Well, at least let me go too. Isn't but one suit, said Captain Britt. Now, Tom Swift, if you're ready, here's the suit. All set, said the young inventor calmly. He began to remove his outer clothing. End, please bring up my rifle. By the time the young scientist had been helped into the massively armored suit, End was back on deck carrying a peculiar-looking gun. Unlike other weapons, this one could discharge a bolt of electricity, which would slay the largest animal or merely tickle a baby, according to the adjustment. Tom set it to its highest power. They helped Tom into the suit. Good luck, cried End as the heavy helmet was lowered into place. Tom attempted to wave in reply, but the gear was too weighty. Later, when he got into the depths, the buoyant effect of the water would enable him to move more freely. Ned carried a peculiar gun, clutching his gun in his armored hand. Tom crept slowly onto the platform suspended over the sea. As it was lowered to the water, he got a last glimpse of End Newton's face staring down at him. The young business manager paced the deck of the barge at every step reproaching himself for allowing his chum to undertake so hazardous a venture. As his watch told him that Tom must be nearing the bottom, he seated himself by the switchboard, headphones clamped over his ears. Tom crept slowly to the platform. Ground floor, announced Tom at last. Pretty dark down here, I'll switch on my flash. Now by George, Ned heard a muffled silence. Tom, Tom, he shouted frantically. What's happened? Are you all right? For nearly 10 minutes, Ned, Crouched by the instrument trying to get in touch with his friend, just as he was giving up hope, he heard a weak voice gasp. "Ground floor," announced Tom. "Not so loud, old man. You've nearly broken my eardrums. Everything's under control." "Hooray," shouted End. "He's found him, Captain Britain." "Easy," protested Tom from the depths. "Don't shout like that so near the phone." "Yes, the men are okay. A big fish had him. Don't know what it was, as I never heard of anything like it. But a couple of shots from the rifle killed it. A big fish had M. Tell Captain Britain to send down some heavy chains. We've found the meteorite." The now jubilant crew who had feared their companions lost scurried about. In a few minutes, the stout chain was snaking its way down through the blue-green ocean. "Seems to me they're taking a mighty long time about it," said Ned to Captain Britain after an hour had passed with no word from the three divers. A chain snaked its way down. "You're right," agreed the other. "Working at that depth, it's decidedly unsafe to stay below so long, I'll warn Tom." "Can't be done," was that young man's decisive answer to the old salvage expert's warning. "This is a tougher job than I thought, for the bottom of the stone seems to be sinking slowly. If we can't finish our job now, I'm afraid we'll lose our prize. But don't worry, we ought to be through in another 20 minutes. This is a tough job. The 20 minutes passed, and another like period was nearly run through before Tom announced himself and the other two ready to come to the surface to avoid the dreaded bends, an affliction suffered by divers drawn to the surface too rapidly. They made their ascent as slowly as their descent. Thus it was that the great meteorite reached the top long before Tom and the two natives did. They made their ascent slowly. "What in the name, oh tarnation, did he want with that?" demanded Captain Britain as the giant stone was lowered cautiously to the deck. Weighing many tons, it had tilted the barge far over to one side as the powerful derrick drew it up. "It looks like some old rock a man might pick up most any place. Oh, Tom Swift usually has a good reason for everything he does," smiled End noncommittally. "I'm no scientist, but he is, so perhaps he wants to experiment with this stone from another planet." The powerful derrick drew it up. At last, the three divers reached the surface and were hauled rapidly up to the deck of the barge. All of them appeared exhausted, but Tom's eyes expressed the greatest satisfaction when he saw the meteorite safely aboard. At his request, the tug was put underway and the Betsy B started back to her home port in Key West. During the trip, Tom managed to cut from the meteorite a 50-pound chunk. Tom cut off a large chunk. "I'm very eager to see if this stone contains more X," he explained to End, "so I'm planning to fly straight home with this sample to analyze it. I want you to put the rest of the meteorite on a fast freight train and travel north with it." The sun was setting when the dock at Key West was reached. Tom waited no longer than was necessary to take on a supply of gasoline for the Winged Arrow. He paid Captain Britain a generous fee and added a bonus for the divers who had helped him. Then, with a hasty goodbye, the excited young inventor roared off in the gathering darkness toward his distant home. He paid Captain Britain. After an uneventful flight, he reached Shopton at about 1:30 the following morning. The wheels of the plane had barely stopped turning when the tall figure of Koku came rushing out of the shadows of the hangar to greet his master. Koku came rushing out. "You're right on the job," exclaimed Tom, climbing stiffly from the cabin. "How is everything?" "All thing good," declared the giant, grinning to see the young inventor back. "Catch him, Skystone?" "We caught it, all right. You might tote this sample of it over to the lab." Tom handed his servant the segment he had chiseled from the main mass. "Master knows about secret cave under laboratory?" questioned the giant as the two walked across the field in the moonlight. "Tote this sample to the lab." "Cave, oh, you mean the vault?" asked Tom, who had been thinking of other matters. "Night you go way in Skybird, Koku watch." "Koku here, bell go, ting ting ting." Suddenly Tom was paying strict attention. "Great Scott, do you mean to say someone broke into my chest of secrets? Tell me about it quickly." Tom paid strict attention. "Chapter X success. Me tell," said Koku. "Here, bell, no bad man's hide in cave. I creep up and watch." His dramatic pause might have seemed funny at any other time, but Tom was badly worried. Tom Swift was worried. "Hurry up," commanded the young inventor sharply, grabbing the giant's arm. "What happened?" "Nothing happen, US," answered Koku. "Plenty happen him. I catch him, fella, crawl up from cave, knock him out, callum policemans." "Good boy, you rate a new suit for that. You can tell the tailor to make it as loud as you like." Nothing could have pleased the simple giant more, for he loved to dress up in gaudy clothes, a trait left over from his savage life before the young inventor had brought him to America. "I catch him, fella." Too excited to sleep, Tom Swift went straight to his office and called the police station. The desk Sargent verified what Koku had said and asked the young scientist to come down and prefer charges. As he was about to leave, he saw, on top of his accumulated mail, a letter from the Apex Glassworks. It was from Mr. Stern. The man advised Tom that he suspected two discharged workmen as the pair who had attempted to rob him. Photographs were enclosed. Photographs were enclosed. That he, master? Suddenly boomed Koku, who had been gazing at the photos. That man steal green glass thing I catch back. By Jove, I believe you're right, declared Tom. This picture most certainly resembles the fellow you dragged in here. Come on, you and I will go over to the jail and check up. Late as the hour was, the two took out a car and hastened over to the county prison. No sooner had the sleepy officer on duty conducted them back to the prisoner's cell than Tom immediately recognized the man as the one Koku had captured with the green disc. They drove to the county prison, eager to get off as lightly as possible. The fellow, who had been a confidential clerk in the main offices of the Glassworks, made a full confession. It was Hammer who got me into this, Mr. Swift, whined Anton. He overheard Mr. Stern talking about your experiments with bendable glass. He said you'd surely succeed and that the invention would be worth a fortune. So we decided to steal your formula. I've got a sick wife, Mr. Swift, Hammer overheard Mr. Stern. A pack of lies, roughly interrupted the policeman. He's a single man, Mr. Swift, and has a police record to boot. Well, hold him, and I hope you will catch his confederate. Don't worry, the boys'll bring him in. He has a police record. Although the hour was late, Tom decided to return to the laboratory and inspect the vault. There had been a certain sly expression in Anton's eyes which had vaguely disturbed the inventor. It was as if the man were holding something back and grinning over it. In a few minutes, Tom's feeling was proven correct, for the formula dealing with the flexible glass was gone. Koku, when questioned, admitted that he had seen some papers drop from Anton's pocket when he had seized him just outside the laboratory, but the simple giant had paid no attention to them. There followed a frantic search with a flashlight by Tom, but there was no trace of the missing documents. The formula was gone. They couldn't have blown away, he declared. They were clipped together by a special heavy binder. Somebody must have picked them up. He made a frantic search. When Tom visited Anton in jail the next day, the fellow denied loudly that he had taken anything. The police promised to redouble their efforts to capture Hammer. With that assurance, the inventor was forced to content himself. The next few days, Tom was so busy that he gave only an occasional thought to his loss. Analysis of the sample cut from the meteorite showed that it was even richer than he had hoped in the new substance. Immediately he telegraphed a large science supply house for huge flasks, beakers, retorts, and other paraphernalia necessary to extract and refine the material. The sample was rich in X. This done, he arranged for the loan of a large refracting telescope from a nearby observatory to be used in conjunction with the big green disc he proposed to make. Professor Standish of the college was so interested in the project that Tom invited him to the forthcoming test. Work was begun on an improvised observatory to be erected on a mountain in the Adirondacks. This would place the telescope above most of the blurring effects of the dense lower atmosphere, filled as it is with smoke and dust. Work was begun on the observatory. Ned Newton wired that the meteorite had been safely placed on a fast freight train. He added that he was traveling in the caboose of the same train by special arrangement with the road officials. Tom met his chum at the station. How do you like riding in style? He teased. Ned traveled in the caboose. Humph, grunted End. I'll take a plane next time. A huge truck transported the Planet Stone to the shops of the Swift Construction Company. One of the buildings had been cleared of all other work, and in it a very large furnace had been erected to cast the green disc. Powerful mechanisms crushed the meteorite to a fine powder, which was dissolved by strong acids, then separated into its various ingredients. The meteorite was crushed. The furnace will have to be enlarged, declared Tom. I had planned to make a disc 20 feet long, but there is so much X that we can easily make it 35 feet. There'll still be several hundred pounds left. Why not use it all and make the biggest scope you can? Suggested Ned Newton. I believe this will be large enough. Besides, I have an idea that the X has other and even more remarkable powers. I don't want to use it all up in this device. We can make a larger disc. A gang of men had been employed to clear a trail up the side of the mountain in the Adirondacks and construct a road to the summit, as none ever had been made to the spot Tom intended to use. Especially, large motor truck was built to carry first the telescope, then the giant green disc. It may well be supposed that all these preparations ran into money. Many a groan did End give when he studied the mounting cost, sheets. Tom, however, was deaf to all his chum's protestations. A special truck was built. I had hoped your new bendable glass would more than repay the cost of your telescope, grumbled Ned. That's gone, and it looks to me as though everything else'll go too. The Swift Construction Company will soon be bankrupt, Tom Swift, if you don't slow down. What do you mean, my flexible glass is gone? Why, I've had an application on file in the patent office for several months. Well, for Pete's sake, why didn't you tell me? Here I've been worrying my head off for nothing. You'll be bankrupt, warned End. Sorry, old man, but you know I've had a lot on my mind. However, we must get back the papers, for the thief can make things pretty uncomfortable if he chooses to. As Tom had found out, X would be useful only in an absolutely pure state. To refine it to the proper degree was a painfully slow process, taking in this case a full 6 weeks. While his chemists labored away, under the young inventor's supervision, everything else had been made ready. At last, the new element was prepared. The tons of yellow powder were dumped into the heated furnace. His chemists worked away. 3 days later, the stuff had cooled sufficiently for an inspection to be made. A traveling crane slowly hoisted the massive iron lid of the electric furnace. Tom climbed a ladder and peered down. It's perfect, he shouted a moment later. Mr. Damon and Barton Swift were standing anxiously, with End and the workmen to hear the verdict. At the young inventor's words, the group gave a cheer. Tom peered down at the disc. Bless my stars and planets, cried Mr. Damon, capering about like a boy. I can hardly wait till you have your big glass set up. It won't be long now, promised Tom, much pleased himself, while the giant disc was being given a final electrical treatment. The youthful inventor was called to the police station. The fugitive, Crookhammer, had finally been nabbed, still with the formula for the bendable glass in his possession. Tom was glad to get this back, even though patent proceedings were underway for anyone holding the papers could have instituted a costly legal contest. Hammer had been nabbed. At last, the time arrived when the great disc was wrapped in hundreds of bales of cotton, suspended on racks and loaded onto the great truck. Tom insisted upon riding with his precious creation. The rest of his party, including his father, N. Newton, Mr. Damon, Professor Standish, Koku, and Rad, traveled by train to the foot of the mountain. The disc was loaded on the truck. Massa Tom gonna look about 6 scrillion miles through space, confided Eradicate Sampson to Koku. The old Negro leaned heavily upon the massive arm of his huge companion. He see wonderful things. He sure make big medicine, declared the giant, for once agreeing with his old rival. He had only the vaguest idea about what his master was attempting. Koku and Rad went along when the entire group assembled. On top the mountain there was a sudden hush. The sun had set in, a fiery glow that presaged a clear night, and now darkness overtook the expectant onlookers. At last Tom stepped to the giant telescope and adjusted it upon the planet Mars. He electrified the immense disc, which glowed then could not be seen at all. Looking through the eyepiece, the young inventor stood as though transfixed. 1 minute, two, Tom stepped to the telescope. Tom, how does it work? Asked Ned finally, unable to restrain himself any longer. Look for yourself, cried Tom, turning from the instrument. His face wore an expression of awe. Ned quickly took his place. Marvelous, he exclaimed, before his eyes were revealed a great city nearly 75 million miles distant. Peculiar people surged along the avenues, weird aircraft thronged the upper atmosphere, and gigantic buildings and palaces dotted the place. All on far distant Mars, he saw a gigantic city. As each one in Tom's party saw the wonderful sight, he in turn congratulated the youthful inventor in his own way. End grasped his chum's hand but could say nothing. Mr. Damon blessed the distant stars. Koku and Rad fell upon their knees. Into the eyes of Barton Swift came tears as he said, Tom, my son, you have performed the greatest miracle of the age. You have performed a miracle. Read these interesting BOOKS2 airplanes. War. Superscience Tom Swift and his giant telescope. Mandrake the Magician and the Midnight Monster. Men with Wings. Thrilling story of flyers. Tailspin Tommy and the Sky Bandits. Captain Frank Hawks, famous air ace, and the League of 12. Pat Nelson, ace of test pilots. Mac of the MARINES in war-torn China. Barney BAXDER in the air with the Eagle Squadron. Buck Rogers, 25th century AD, in the war with the planet Venus. Flash GORDON in the Forest Kingdom of Mongo. Skyroads with Clipper Williams of the Flying Legion. Don WNSLOW of the Navy versus the Scorpion. Gang, read these thrilling BOOKS2 cowboys. Indians. Horses, the Lone Ranger and the Red Renegades. With Silver and Tonto, Jaragu, Indian Boy of the Jungle, Rex Beach, Tim McCoy on the Tomahawk Trail, Buck Jones and the Rock Creek Cattle War. Tom Mix and the Horde of Montezuma, Ken Mayanard and Western Justice, Bronc Peeler, the Lone Cowboy, Flame Boy and the Indians Secret, Tex Thorne Comes Out of the West, the Texas Kid, Guns in the Roaring West, King of the Royal Mounted Gets His, Man Zane Grey Read These Exciting BOOKS2 Mysteries, Thrills, Adventures, The Phantom and the Sign of the Skull, Terry and the Pirates and the Giant's Vengeance, Jane Arden and the Vanished Princess, Myra North, Special Nurse and Foreign Spies, Little Orphan Annie and the Mysterious, Shoemaker, Tarzan's Revenge, Edgar Rice Burroughs, KDARCY and the Mystery Hideout, Blaze Brandon with the Foreign Legion, Little Annie Roney on the Highway to Adventure, Mary Lee and the Indian Bead Mystery, Wash TUBBS and Capped, Easy Hunting for Whales, Jack Armstrong, All-American Boy and the Ivory Treasure, Brick Bradford Fighting Brocco the Modern, Buccaneer. End of the project. GUTMBRGEBOOK Tom Swift and his Giant Telescope asterisk asterisk. Updated editions will replace the previous one. The old editions will be renamed. Creating the works from print editions not protected by U.S. copyright. Law means that no one owns a United States copyright in these works. So the foundation and you can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules set forth in the general terms of use part of this license apply to copying and distributing project. Gutenberg trademark electronic works to protect the project GUTMBRGTM concept and trademark. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark and may not be used if you charge for an ebook, except by following the terms of the trademark license, including paying royalties for use of the Project Gutenberg trademark. If you do not charge anything for copies of this ebook, complying with the trademark license is very easy. You may use this ebook for nearly any purpose, such as creation of derivative works, reports, performances, and research. Project Gutenberg ebooks may be modified and printed and given away. You may do practically anything in the United States with ebooks not protected by U.S. copyright law. Redistribution is subject to the trademark license, especially commercial redistribution. Start full license. The full Project GUTMBRGTM license. Please read this before you distribute or use this work to protect the Project Gutenberg trademark mission of promoting the free distribution of electronic works by using or distributing this work or any other work associated in any way with the phrase Project Gutenberg. You agree to comply with all the terms of the full Project Gutenberg license available with this file or online at www.gutenberg.org/license. Section 1. General Terms of Use and Redistributing Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. 1A. By reading or using any part of this Project Gutenberg electronic work, you indicate that you have read, understand, agree to, and accept all the terms of this license and intellectual property trademark copyright agreement. If you do not agree to abide by all the terms of this agreement, you must cease using and return or destroy all copies of Project Gutenberg electronic works in your possession. If you paid a fee for obtaining a copy of or access to a Project Gutenberg electronic work and you do not agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement, you may obtain a refund from the person or entity to whom you paid the fee as set forth in paragraph 1E8, 1B. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark. It may only be used on or associated in any way with an electronic work by people who agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement. There are a few things that you can do with most Project Gutenberg electronic works, even without complying with the full terms of this agreement. C. Paragraph 1C below. There are a lot of things you can do with Project Gutenberg electronic works if you follow the terms of this agreement and help preserve free future access to Project Gutenberg electronic works. See paragraph 1E below 1C. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the Foundation or PGLAF, owns a compilation copyright in the collection of Project Gutenberg electronic works. Nearly all the individual works in the collection are in the public domain in the United States. If an individual work is unprotected by copyright law in the United States and you are located in the United States, we do not claim a right to prevent you from copying, distributing, performing, displaying, or creating derivative works based on the work as long as all references to Project Gutenberg are removed. Of course, we hope that you will support the Project Gutenberg mission of promoting free access to electronic works by freely sharing Project Gutenberg works in compliance with the terms of this agreement for keeping the Project Gutenberg name associated with the work. You can easily comply with the terms of this agreement by keeping this work in the same format with its attached full Project Gutenberg license when you share it without charge with others. 1D. The copyright laws of the place where you are located also govern what you can do with this work. Copyright laws in most countries are in a constant state of change. If you are outside the United States, check the laws of your country in addition to the terms of this agreement before downloading, copying, displaying, performing, distributing, or creating derivative works based on this work or any other Project Gutenberg work. The Foundation makes no representations concerning the copyright status of any work in any country other than the United States. 1E. Unless you have removed all references to Project Gutenberg. 1E1. The following sentence, with active links to or other immediate access to the full Project Gutenberg license, must appear prominently whenever any copy of a Project Gutenberg work, any work on which the phrase Project Gutenberg appears, or with which the phrase Project Gutenberg is associated, is accessed, displayed, performed, viewed, copied, or distributed. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg trademark license included with this ebook or online. www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. 1E2. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is derived from texts not protected by U.S. copyright law, does not contain a notice indicating that it is posted with permission of the copyright holder, the work can be copied and distributed to anyone in the United States without paying any fees or charges. If you are redistributing or providing access to work with the phrase Project Gutenberg associated with or appearing on the work, you must comply either with the requirements of paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7, or obtain permission for the use of the work and the Project Gutenberg trademark as set forth in paragraphs 1E8 or 1E9. 1E3. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is posted with the permission of the copyright holder, your use and distribution must comply with both paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 and any additional terms imposed by the copyright holder. Additional terms will be linked to the Project Gutenberg license for all works posted with the permission of the copyright holder found at the beginning of this work. 1E4. Do not unlink or detach or remove the full Project Gutenberg license terms from this work or any files containing a part of this work or any other work associated with Project Gutenberg. 1E5. Do not copy, display, perform, distribute, or redistribute this electronic work or any part of this electronic work without prominently displaying the sentence set forth in paragraph 1E1 with active links or immediate access to the full terms of the Project Gutenberg license. 1E6. You may convert to and distribute this work in any binary, compressed, marked up, non-proprietary or proprietary form, including any word processing or hypertext form. However, if you provide access to or distribute copies of a Project Gutenberg work in a format other than plain vanilla ASCII or other format used in the official version posted on the official Project Gutenberg website, www.gutenberg.org, you must, at no additional cost, fee, or expense to the user, provide a copy, a means of exporting a copy, or a means of obtaining a copy upon request of the work in its original plain vanilla ASCII or other form. Any alternate format must include the full Project Gutenberg license as specified in paragraph 1E1, 1E7. Do not charge a fee for access to viewing, displaying, performing, copying, or distributing any Project Gutenberg works, unless you comply with paragraph 1E8 or 1E9. 1E8. You may charge a reasonable fee for copies of or providing access to or distributing Project Gutenberg electronic works, provided that you pay a royalty fee of 20% of the gross profits you derive from the use of Project Gutenberg works calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. The fee is owed to the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, but he has agreed to donate royalties under this paragraph to the project, Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Royalty payments must be paid within 60 days following each date on which you prepare or are legally required to prepare your periodic tax returns. Royalty payments should be clearly marked as such and sent to the project, Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation at the address specified in. Section 4, information about donations to the project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. You provide a full refund of any money paid by a user who notifies you in writing or by email within 30 days of receipt that S/he does not agree to the terms of the full Project Gutenberg trademark license. You must require such a user to return or destroy all copies of the works possessed in a physical medium and discontinue all use of and all access to other copies of Project Gutenberg trademark works. You provide, in accordance with paragraph 1F3, a full refund of any money paid for a work or a replacement copy if a defect in the electronic work is discovered and reported to you within 90 days of receipt of the work. You comply with all other terms of this agreement for free distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark works. 1. E9. If you wish to charge a fee or distribute a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work or group of works on different terms than are set forth in this agreement, you must obtain permission in writing from the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the manager of the Project Gutenberg trademark. Contact the foundation as set forth in section 3 below. 1F1F1. Project Gutenberg volunteers and employees expend considerable effort to identify, do copyright research on, transcribe and proofread works not protected by U.S. copyright law in creating the Project Gutenberg trademark collection. Despite these efforts, Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works and the medium on which they may be stored may contain defects, such as, but not limited to, incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, transcription errors, a copyright or other intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other medium, a computer virus or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. 1F2. Limited warranty disclaimer of damages, except for the right of replacement or refund described in paragraph 1F3, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, and any other party distributing a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work under this agreement, disclaim all liability to you for damages, costs, and expenses, including legal fees. You agree that you have no remedies for negligence, strict liability, breach of warranty, or breach of contract except those provided in paragraph 1F3. You agree that the foundation, THE, trademark owner, and any distributor under this agreement will not be liable to you for actual, direct, indirect, consequential, punitive, or incidental damages, even if you give notice of the possibility of such damage. 1F3. Limited right of replacement or refund. If you discover a defect in this electronic work within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it by sending a written explanation to the person you received the work from. If you receive the work on a physical medium, you must return the medium with your written explanation. The person or entity that provided you with the defective work may elect to provide a replacement copy in lieu of a refund. If you receive the work electronically, the person or entity providing it to you may choose to give you a second opportunity to receive the work electronically in lieu of a refund. If the second copy is also defective, you may demand a refund in writing without further opportunities to fix the problem. 1F4. Except for the limited right of replacement or refund set forth in paragraph 1F3, this work is provided to you as is with no other warranties of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to warranties of MERC CHANTIBLITY or fitness for any purpose. 1F5. Some states do not allow disclaimers of certain implied warranties or the exclusion or limitation of certain types of damages. If any disclaimer or limitation set forth in this agreement violates the law of the state applicable to this agreement, the agreement shall be interpreted to make the maximum disclaimer or limitation permitted by the applicable state law. The invalidity or unenforceability of any provision of this agreement shall not void the remaining provisions. 1F6. Indemnity. You agree to indemnify and hold the foundation, the trademark owner, any agent or employee of the foundation, anyone. Providing copies of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works in accordance with this agreement, and any volunteers associated with the production, promotion, and distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works, harmless from all liability, costs, and expenses, including legal fees that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following which you do or cause to occur: a distribution of this or any Project Gutenberg work, b. alteration, modification, or additions or deletions to any Project Gutenberg work, and c. any defect you cause, Section 2. Information about the mission of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg is synonymous with the free distribution of electronic works in formats readable by the widest variety of computers, including obsolete, old, middle-aged, and new computers. It exists because of the efforts of hundreds of volunteers and donations from people in all walks of life. Volunteers and financial support to provide volunteers with the assistance they need are critical to reaching Project Gutenberg goals and ensuring that the Project Gutenberg collection will remain freely available for generations to come. In 2001, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation was created to provide a secure and permanent future for Project Gutenberg and future generations. To learn more about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation and how your efforts and donations can help, see Sections 3 and 4 and the Foundation Information page at www.gutenberg.org, Section 3. Information about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation is a nonprofit 501(c)(3) educational corporation organized under the laws of the state of Mississippi and granted tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service. The foundation's EIN or federal tax identification number is 64622-1541. Contributions to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation are tax deductible to the full extent permitted by U.S. federal laws and your state's laws. The foundation's business office is located at 41 Watchung Plaza 516, Montclair, NJ 7042, USA, plus 1-862-621-9288. Email contact links and up-to-date contact information can be found at the foundation's website and official page at www.gutenberg.org/contact, Section 4. Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Project Gutenberg trademark depends upon and cannot survive without widespread public support and donations to carry out its mission of increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form accessible by the widest array of equipment, including outdated equipment. Many small donations, $1 to $5,000, are particularly important to maintaining tax-exempt status with the IRS. The foundation is committed to complying with the laws regulating charities and charitable donations in all 50 states of the United States. Compliance requirements are not uniform, and it takes a considerable effort, much paperwork, and many fees to meet and keep up with these requirements. We do not solicit donations in locations where we have not received written confirmation of compliance. To send donations or determine the status of compliance for any particular state, visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. While we cannot and do not solicit contributions from states where we have not met the solicitation requirements, we know of no prohibition against accepting unsolicited donations from donors in such states who approach us with offers to donate. International donations are gratefully accepted, but we cannot make any statements concerning tax treatment of donations received from outside the United States. U.S. laws alone swamp our small staff. Please check the Project Gutenberg web pages for current donation methods and addresses. Donations are accepted in a number of other ways, including checks, online payments, and credit card donations. To donate, please visit www.gutenberg.org/donate, Section 5. General information about Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. Professor Michael S. Hart was the originator of the project Gutenberg concept of a library of electronic works that could be freely shared with anyone. For 40 years, he produced and distributed Project Gutenberg ebooks with only a loose network of volunteer support. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as not protected by copyright in the US unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we do not necessarily keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper. Edition, most people start at our website, which has the main PG search facility, www.gutenberg.org. This website includes information about Project Gutenberg, including how to make donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter to hear about new ebooks. This is the end of the audiobook. Thank you for listening. You can listen to and download more audiobooks at threeords.com.